You are listening to Documentally.com. Episode 8. Okay, so I'm joined today by Colin Fallows. Some people would call him a speed freak, some people would call him an engineer. What would you call yourself?
Superb engineer. Good looking, tall, dark and handsome.
Well, there we excellent. No comment.
It's got to kill that. Well, the British land speed record was actually held by Richard Noble in Thrust 2 for about 10, 12 years. The UK record. Nobody's ever challenged that. So Mark and I, when we formed our partnership, we decided that rather than drag racing all the time, we would go record breaking. Richard's record was 269 mile an hour. And we didn't involve any officials or the RAC or any bodies. We just went out there for the day with the news. With news crews and TV, and broke the record. Well, we didn't actually break it at 300 then, because our record breaking adventures, we've been dogged, people will say, with bad luck. I'll put it down to bad weather or typical British weather. We was at Thurloy, and the winds was absolutely horrendous. We couldn't run our estimated speed, so we ran, I think it was only about 20 mile an hour faster than Richard's record, but considering the weather conditions, it was pretty good. All the TV newspapers recorded it, and then all the official bodies said, you can't claim this. So our sponsors had a week of TV and media coverage, which was absolutely brilliant for them, and then we set about doing this officially.
So there's a lot of bureaucracy.
The bureaucracy is unbelievable. If there's a spanner they can put in the works, they'll put the whole toolbox in.
Is this why records are there for so long, do you think?
I think it's one of the reasons is the officialdom from the governing body. They're really no help at all.
So how many cars did you actually use for the final breaking of 300 miles an hour?
We used two cars. Over the period of our partnership, I already had one jet car, which was tailor-made for me. And Mark, partner, he's somewhat taller than me. He was a little bit cramped inside it. So we decided at this stage that we need another car.
In your car, which was Vampire, I believe, you used an engine out of a Red Arrow.
That's it, yeah. So Rolls-Royce Orpheus. And that actually flew with the Red Arrow aerobatic team, and for the real anoraks that are listening to this, it was following that X1001 that it actually flew in. And that Nat is still flying in private hands.
Oh wow, just without your engine.
Without this engine, yes.
Is it your history of being so you were an RAF propulsion technician for
that's all, right, yeah.
Without that, you couldn't be just picking up these engines and tinkering around with them, surely?
Yeah, they're a very, very simple engine to work on. It's kind of understanding how they work, knowing what you can do. Bearing in mind the engines we use are built by Rolls-Royce, and Rolls-Royce have a pretty good history of building engines that work. Both engines that we use have got afterburners on. These aren't available from Rolls-Royce. They weren't an afterburner engine. So we have to make our own afterburner systems.
What kind of horsepower are you getting from one of these engines?
The one in Vampire is the big Rolls-Royce Orpheus. That's an old 1950s design, kind of a big lazy engine. That produces roughly about 10,000 horsepower. The other engine we use, which is a Rolls-Royce Viper, it's the 500 series, that's a small, compact, slightly later design engine, but produces roughly the same power.
Is that the one in Mark's car?
That's in Mark's split second car.
Split second.
Yeah.
So at the point of 300 miles an hour on the average run, that average speed that got you the record, at the point of that being broken, you weren't just the engineer, you were actually in the driving seat.
Yeah, I drive it. And it's a time when you're sitting in the car and you're running at 300 miles an hour, you kind of, it's all over in seconds, really, the run, when you think of it. But you sit there, you've got all the time in the world, and you're thinking, yeah, I'm sure I tightened that up, and I'm sure I put plenty of oil in that bit there. It's these little things that go through your minds.
What's the worst that can happen?
I think tyres. We're running on the edge of tyre technology. The tyres we're using are rated to just over 300 mile an hour. So we're buzzing them up over the 300, because although it's an average speed of a two-way pass that gives you gave us a 300 mile an hour, you're exiting somewhere around about 350, 360 mile an hour. So you're kind of on the edge of these tyres, and so that's the killing factor on the tyres, is a centrifugal force, because they kind of expand off the rims.
I mean, I ride a motorbike, and there are times when you do have a sobering moment, and you think, if this corner coming up, if I have a blowout, that's it.
Yeah, we have many sobering moments. We think of them afterwards, actually. In all the time that we've been running, we've only lost one tyre, and that was on split second. And after the 300 mile an hour, the first 300 mile an hour run we've done, one of the tyres, as we towed it back, got out of the car, you could hear it gradually deflating, where the centrifugal force has expanded it just enough to break the bead on the seal on the rim. Could have been a problem. And also bird strikes is a problem, especially on the airfields.
Yeah.
We've decimated half the wildlife in Bedfordshire, I think. We was at an air show at Cranfield, and we hit a hare. It was only about 260, 270 mile an hour down a runway, and we hit a hare which took the nose cone off, and it actually bent the front axle and twisted the front chassis, and made a hell of a mess all underneath the car.
That is extreme roadkill.
Oh, that was extreme roadkill. So a 10-pound rabbit. The problem with the rabbit, he most probably was so used to aircraft coming down a runway that he just ambled across the runway, thinking that normally an aircraft noise, it'd be airborne by now. Of course, it wasn't. It was a car.
I heard a story once where they were testing the windscreens on Intercity 125s or other high-speed trains, and they literally build a cannon and they fire birds at the windscreen.
Back to my youth when I was in the Air Force, we used to do this what was called battle damage. They used to hang an aircraft fuselage up in a big framework, usually minus wings or something like that, run the engine up, and they used to fire a few rounds of cannon fire, shell fire, small arms fire through, and then we had to assess how we can fix it, how quick it does. And also we used to do that with the engines. We used to fire chickens in the intake of the engines.
Obviously not frozen.
Actually, they were frozen, actually, because if you put an ordinary dead chicken in a cannon and you fire it, it just comes out as pulp. So you've got to have your frozen chicken to get going.
So if you could survive the impact of a frozen chicken, you're going to be pretty okay with a live one.
That's it, yeah. You should be, but the feathers tend to get between your teeth, I think.
So but, there you are at 300 miles an hour, and you've just reached the realisation that this is it. It's you on the second run, and you've done it. Obvious question, how does it feel?
Oh, it's the biggest adrenaline rush you can possibly think of. It's kind of a legal way of taking drugs, I would assume. It's a very, very good feeling, especially all the hard work and the hassle you have doing it. And the biggest thing is the official body of saying, I've done it, thanks for all the hassle you've given me, now giving me my certificate. Which, incidentally, we had to wait 6 months for. Because not only once you've broke the record, the governing body has to ratify the record, but you have to pay them extra for your certificate.
Where's your certificate hanging?
I was going to hang it in the loo, but it's actually in the front room.
This is what's the downer like afterwards? Because let's face it, the point of you breaking that record, you're now unemployed.
You're quite right. It's the only business that once you've reached it, you're unemployed. You have to do it again.
You are listening to a Documentally podcast.
Now, what we decided to do after running the Jets and doing the UK record, we decided that it would be really nice if we'd done something for the environment. We'll build this electric powered streamliner.
This is called Emotion.
Emotion, yeah. Mm. And we thought, how easy would it be from going to Jets to going to an electric car? Which was really, really difficult.
A different world, I imagine.
It's a totally different world. The first thing that happened, we announced we was going to. When we actually got the record, you can see it on video, on the TV footage. They said, what are you going to do next? And there I stood holding the Union Jack saying, oh, we're going to build an electric car. We'll be back next year with an electric car. And that was it. Committed ourselves in front of millions of people.
Did it take a year?
No. we quickly knocked a design together. We had a car built in about 6.5 months.
Oh.
And
is this the car that looks like a huge pencil?
That's it, yeah.
What would you say is the major kind of trauma connected with going for world records in speed? Would it be the limits in technology or the funding?
Funding. We was on a budget all the time. It is working to a budget. That's the most frustrating thing. We've been very good with all our sponsors. They transferred over from the from the Jets to the electric car, except one. What happened, we were sponsored for oil and fuel by a company. I won't mention the company, but they've got a big Shell as a logo. And when we announced that we was doing an electric car, we lost that within about a week. And their letter, which I've got framed, says that we can't support this because it may take petrol sales away.
Aren't Shell the company that actually bought all the latest technology involving electric cars?
Oh, I think Shell just bought, they will buy that sort of thing and then put it to one side, because oil companies like to be seen to be green, but when it actually comes to doing something, no, they're not really interested.
So that's really, I mean, that is really interesting to me, that the limits are, if you've got enough money, you can go out and do that, because the technology is around.
Yeah. Now, our annual budget to keep the two Jets going and the electric car going would keep McLaren going for about 4 hours.
Wow.
We're you know, that's the difference. I mean, we've all got proper jobs.
So you're up against odds.
Oh, we're up against it. The guys that have presently got the record, electric car record, which officially is 248 mile an hour, is a car called White Lightning, driven by a guy called Pat Rummerfield. And we've spoken to him, and he's quite a nice guy. And they've reached the limit of technology on their car, so it won't run any faster. So that's just kind of a museum piece now, or it may come out for exhibition work or things like that. We, on the outset of our building our car, the outset was that all the equipment we use on the car is stuff that's available on the shelf. Anybody could go down and buy this equipment and put it together and run it. The trick is putting it together, and the art is making it work. Once we got the car up and running, it was then to find a venue to run it.
If I wanted to go out tomorrow to Maplin's or wherever with a shopping list,
yep,
because everything's available off the shelves, you say. What kind of price am I looking at?
Drive control unit is about £18,000. The motors are about £12,000 each. The batteries, which was supplied by Exide, we have three packs of batteries. One pack's about about £9,000 for a pack of batteries. We went for a gel battery. We used 54 of them, and it makes up 2/3 of the weight of the car.
Pretty heavy then.
Pretty heavy batteries, but absolutely brilliant because we get so much power out of them.
So whereas with jet technology, kind of you're held up with tyre technology. With the electric car, you're held up with the battery technology.
Battery technology. But on the research of trying to find batteries, there's a company out in Korea that can make batteries for you, and they can mould them virtually any shape. And they've done a car where the batteries are actually moulded into the dashboard tops, door panels, because they take a lot of space up.
You could just surely slot them into the space frame.
You could get them custom made to fit. That's why we're kind of a fairly boxy chassis, because we've got square batteries.
Yeah. What happened to hydrogen fuel cells? I mean, where are they?
A lot of companies seem to be doing these fuel cells, but the energy that's used to produce the cell in the first place kind of outweighs what the emissions that it doesn't put out. This is where people now, I think, are going over to biodiesel and ethanol fuels, which is a lot cheaper to produce. Alcohol-based, you get that. That's, I think, will be the future propulsion rather than pure electric.
That's where you see the future, then.
I think so. It's personally for me, I think it's going to be biodiesel. Electric will catch on. I mean, Honda have got their hybrids and everything, and they're pretty good. In fact, my partner Mark, he's good. He's just had got rid of his Avensis, and he's just bought a silver one. It's the same one, but it's a four door.
Technically speaking,
yeah, it's a silver one. It's the technology is there, but battery technology has really got to change.
Are we being held back by the fuel companies?
Oh, most definitely. If you've got a monopoly on a fuel and somebody comes along and says, "Oh, look, I've just got this engine that I can run on water," you're going to make a fortune on that because they want to buy it.
So,
but they wouldn't develop it.
No,
it goes in the vaults.
So you've been getting, I imagine, quite a decent insight into kind of the environmental impact and the whole.
Yeah,
whole
we've done kind of quite a lot of environmental shows and bits and pieces with the electric car, and you kind of find an insight of, especially how this government works. We've done a couple of government things for them, and you find out exactly how the politicians, when you speak to them, how they really work. If one politician's got two Jaguars, I'm sure he's not going to change that to a little Honda. But getting back to the electric car, once we got the car built and up and running, it was back to the problem of finding a venue to run, and we went to Tunisia, and we ended up just by chance right in southern Tunisia, and we come driving through this causeway, and there's like desert either side. We thought, what's this? And it's the salt flats. So we went on there. Absolutely brilliant. Measured it out, plenty of distance. Right, this is it. So we set up for the following year to go out there. It was the hardest thing we've ever done, because we drove out to Tunisia. We drove from Northampton down to Dover, ferry from Dover, Calais. Drove from Calais all the way down to Marseille, and a ferry from Marseille over to Tunisia.
You should have took the Vampire.
But anyhow, we left here, typical British weather. It poured a rain all the way down there. And we got there. It was a nightmare journey. But setting the whole thing up from just the paperwork, because we hired a lorry to tow the trailer, because we had to take everything from generators, battery packs. If something was going to break, we had to take a spare. Welding equipment. We took everything you could possibly think of. Lousy trip all the way there. 2 hours in the police official thing.
More bureaucracy.
You couldn't believe it. 2 hours there to get our passport stamped and everything. We had 9 hours in customs. And then after 9 hours in customs, we had an hour at the main gate. And this is with our shipping agent who met us out there.
This is the problem when you're doing it all yourself.
Yeah, and then an hour at the main gate to get through. Then the shipping agent says, right, I need paying now. So we had to go into Tunis itself, draw out millions and millions and millions of notes to give us about 50 quid. and pay in. And then we had to drive the whole length of Tunisia at night. Mm. And it was brilliant. It was. We didn't know where we was going. We finally arrived at the hotel and managed to fit it in the car park and had a shower. And it went out the following morning and it rained.
Oh, no.
And it rained for the whole week. Oh. And we went on the salt flats and there wasn't a dry bit.
What was the chance of that, though, I mean?
Oh, the chance, with the luck we have, I would think it was pretty good. And
is this why you call it the Tunisian disaster?
Well, the Tunisians called the day the great rain came, because we drove through a town called Tozeur, and there's a big archway that says Gateway to the Sahara, and it was absolutely pissing down. So we knew we was in for a luckless week. But anyhow, they tried their best in finding another venue road. They was even going to close the airport, the main airport, but the runway just wasn't long because the car was geared for a long distance.
You are listening to Documentary Lee.
So you decided to go to Nevada?
Yeah, so we thought we'll not necessarily Nevada. We was going to go to Russia, first of all.
Oh, right.
It was a bit bloody cold out there, and they've got a 22-mile runway out there.
Wow.
The runway apparently is that long, and there's a story that an aircraft landed in a snowstorm, landed safely and everything, but the blizzard come down and everything, and they lost it for a day. They couldn't find the, you know. But that's the Russians.
You thought bureaucracy in Tunisia was bad. It's probably just as well you didn't make it
that's
to Russia.
That's it, yeah. So we sent a fax, an email to some guys out there who do road racing out in the Nevada desert and everything. And said, look, we're looking for a bit of tarmac. We don't want to use the salt flats if we can really help it.
That's where everybody else goes, though.
Yeah, everybody goes there. And all the good dates are always booked up when it's dry. Because anyhow, he came back and said, yeah, we do this road race and we're in West Wendover and there's a straight there which is 10 miles long. It should be all right for your thing.
This is just a normal stretch of highway.
Yeah, just a normal stretch of single lane highway. And he says, I'll send you over a video. And he's racking along at 200 mile an hour down this road and the camera's really rock steady. And we thought, this is pretty good. So we said, right, we're coming over. Picked us up at the airport. They booked us into a holiday flat for the week, loaded it with all the American goodies, which, you know, if you call popcorn and chocolate and Budweiser was okay, and loaned us his pickup, had many breakfast meetings with different people, and then he took us up to Las Vegas. He took us up to West Wendover, showed us the bit of road, and we thought this is ideal. We went and saw the mayor of West Wendover. For permission to use it, went to the sheriff's department. Can we use it? Will they shut it? Yep. Went to the highways department. Yep, that's no problem. And we come back, and all we had to do was get a surveyor to survey it.
So, this is your expense, or the sponsor's expense?
Oh, this was our own expense. This was.
How much did it cost to shut a road down in America?
Well, bearing in mind we had to pay the sheriff's department to close it. We had to pay MKM Racing for their staff to crowd control it and police it and everything. We had the timing people out there, the timekeepers. We had the crash crew out there. We had to have a helicopter on standby, but we didn't have just in case. We had to have four horsemen because there's wild Mustangs around there, so they had to be got there. There was the radios, there was air airfares out there, the shipping of the car out there, which was 6 days late, it only came to about £76,000.
From what you've just said, actually, I'm not rushing out to try and get my own record.
That was pretty good. That was pretty good going. Of course, we had to have insurance as well.
You sound like you've been doing some haggling along the way as well, then.
Haggling? Well, yeah, done some haggling. And I think if it was truth to be known, it was downright blackmail and stealing at the same time to keep the cost down.
So what happened to the actual record attempt?
Right, the car ran absolutely brilliant in practice, no problems at all. It was like all cars do. And then we kept having a component failure every time you kind of push the throttle open. We had a spike of electricity going where it shouldn't go on the circuit board. If we had a bigger budget, we could have stayed out there a bit longer.
And you would have done it.
We would have done it, but we only had that slot. We just didn't have any more money to stay out there any longer.
When it came to the point where, excuse the pun, you had to pull the plug.
that's a good one. Yeah, I had to make the decision on the last day.
Did you feel like you were just letting everybody?
Oh, yeah, that was it. I think it's the first time Mark and I didn't speak to each other for about a day.
Just through total sorrow.
Yeah, it was sheer frustration that it was something out of our control. You know, it kind of looking at it with hindsight. You know, we spent a lot of money to our standards, but Ferrari spend millions and they can't even get a car to do two laps of a circuit. You know, not that I sit and gloat. But I think of all that technology, they can't even do that. You know,
no, they haven't got you on board.
That's the reason. That's the reason why. But anyhow, we had to call it a day. And the saving grace was the guy from the Salt Lake City Tribune has come up and said, "Well, Colin, what's the problem?" And rather than say, "I think there's a technical problem," I said, "It's absolutely bollocks." Which they printed in their paper, and I thought was absolutely brilliant for a religious Mormon dry state.
Bollocks
in the headlines. I thought that was absolutely wonderful.
If it wasn't for the fact you're a British record breaker as it is, would you feel a failure after that?
Oh yeah, I mean you couldn't describe the feeling because we've had two cracks at it, and it didn't work, and the fact that it was down to something out of our control in Tunisia, it was the weather. That wasn't too bad because it was out of our control. But when it's something that was working fine and then it stopped working, that was hard because we couldn't, even the best minds there, we couldn't fathom out the problem. And at the end of the day, you know, it's just down to funding. If we had more money in the kitty, we could have stayed out there for a little bit longer, but we just didn't have the money to do it. So we come back with our towels between our legs, and we thought, well, nobody's cracked the British record for a time that we hold.
No.
Let's get out there and crack that. And once we've done that, then we'll take another view on what we're doing. You know, the British land speed record with the jets was set, a new British land speed record for an electric car, which only stands at 139 mile an hour, so we can zap that. And then once we've done that, then we'll take a view of what we're going to do next.
Do you have a shortage of drivers by any chance? I'm not doing anything.
You know, we can always run a course for you if you want to go to the fellow stroke newbie jet car school.
That's definitely worth thinking about. Do you personally have any? I mean, Northamptonshire is renowned for speed, not really being.
That's it. Yeah, I mean, you can go in any pub in Northampton and get speed. There's no problem.
No.
Oh, we're talking.
I mean, on the road.
Oh, speed on the road. Right.
Do you have any speeding tickets?
2 weeks after doing a British land speed record, I had the most embarrassing speed ticket you could possibly think of. 34 and a 30 mile an hour limit, but worst of all, it was in a Maestro.
No. Surely they should have just laughed that off and let you off.
Well, I was lucky really, because I went on the awareness course. And I sat there and I thought, shall I go there with my T-shirt, with British Land Speed Record?
Did that make the press, that you got stopped for speed?
I never told anybody. I never told anybody about that. So,
well, I hope that the next time you're caught speeding, it's in excess of 300.3.
That's it. Well, I'll certainly hope so. It's recent testing's anything to go by. We've gone like 30 mile an hour faster than that. So,
will you be driving it ever again?
Yep. I'll be driving Vampire this year. We've got a full program with that. Mark's driving a split second, and Emotion, and who knows what the future brings.
So there's some people out there that are looking to you, that you've had a dream, you've managed to pretty much engineer, organise, get the funding, go out there, do it, get the British record, land speed record, keep hold of it for this period of time. It might look as you as some kind of a hero. Do you have a hero?
Yeah, I've got two. Walt and R. Fonts, American guys, and they've got a kind of a workshop in the States, in a road called Pickle Road. And they were the my heroes. They pioneered loads and loads of stuff. They acquired jet engines before the ministry knew they'd lost them, and they were running these cars. And in the early years, they was running on a weekly basis against each other and the American Craig Breedlove, taking a record each week. It was kind of the heyday of record breaking.
So you're quite an advocate of backyard engineering and innovations from that background.
Yeah, the Americans call it junkyard engineering. I don't know what the Brits call it. Madness, I think. But
eccentricity.
Eccentricity, yes. But it's kind of in a way it is junkyard engineering.
Would you think of yourself as being eccentric?
Not at all. Just ladded these tights. I would think completely eccentric. If you look at stuff I've got in my workshop, I think.
Is it true that you once built a jet bike and rode it round your small Northamptonshire village?
That's right. You can ask the neighbours about that. It's, we decided to build a jet bike. We went down to, I wouldn't say a junkyard, but we went down to a motorcycle shop in Northampton. We bought back wheel, we bought a front wheel and frame, front wheel and forks, and come back and made a frame, put an engine in there. But I thought this was going a little bit over the top, so I let my son drive it. The bike then changed hands. A friend of mine took it off me, and he re-engineered it. And not only did he set a British land speed record for motorcycles, but he created a new class, because there wasn't a thrust drive motorcycle class going, but because it didn't accelerate very fast, he built two solid boost rockets to go on there to aid his acceleration.
Is he still alive?
Yep, and the bike's in the motorcycle museum at Birmingham. It's called the Boost Paloost.
If you had a choice of leaving this world.
When I leave this world, I've got it all worked out. I want to be in a firework.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very similar to Hunter S. Thompson.
Yep, that's it, yep.
They shot his ashes out of a cannon.
Yep, I'd like to have my ashes shot out in a firework. And what I should do, I want it to go off at about 3 o'clock in the morning, right in the middle of from the village, to wake everybody up, and especially all those people who wake me up with their bloody fireworks.
Going out with a bang.
Go out with a bang.
Well, thank you very much, Colin.
Yeah, you're
it's
welcome.
It's been a pleasure.
That's all right.
Good luck for everything in the future.
Okay, mate.
Cheers.
You have been listening to a Documentally podcast on documentally.com. Please feel free to visit the website and leave an email or a comment. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
I think I'm going to crash.